Victor and Nadine were walking closer, then passing right through their bodies of rushing atoms and currents, the dark aureoles of Nadine's breasts spreading her nipples wider, the dream of wings inside the girl, her own swelling, the squeeze of his hands on the girl's belly pushing her closer to her destination. Then, leaning over Velma, she was saying, "She carries their baby in his hands, and they carry our future in their guts," before knocking her sister off the stool. It might have been a fingernail scraping across the window, was Chezius thought, remembering her first encounter with panes not made of the waxed paper or the greased sheep membranes of home, or a goat screaming, was Cecile's, her ears at home on the island where her appetite readied her for rooty and ginger beer. It might have been the shriek of mandragora root uprooted from a bruja's garden, Inez was thinking, wondering if the old hag of her village still lived. But the sound that released them from the moment of freeze was the screech from the birds returning, and after the sudden change in pitch came a change in light that could mean rain, and then a change in texture, the air granular with grit that turned the blues to pink silver and drew eyes toward the windows for signs of a storm. No one remarked on any of this or on any of the other remarkable things each sensed but had no habit of language for, though felt often and deeply, privately. That moment of correspondence, phenomena, noumena, when the glimpse of the life script is called dream, déjà vu, clairvoyance, intuition, hysteria, hunger, or called nothing at all. Released now, lungs sucked air and feet scraped against the grit of the bus floor, but before the passengers could get back to what they'd been doing, they found themselves leaning toward the windshield as the tall woman with the feather pointing up at the ceiling lifted from her seat and shouted, "Look!" as though it were a bubble-top bus. Tendon, feather, bone, and flesh were riding against a backdrop of 8-minute-ago blue, a 50-years-ago blue, rode the curvature to the seam, flying through to what the sages of old had known about gravity and the outer edge, gazing up. Birds, riding the air, riding the sun's beams and back, gliding in light, in and out, hollow-boned and tiny-brained, but sufficient when living in the law.
"Birds," shrugged the driver.
"Birds," said the farm boy in the rear, twisting round in his seat to check the sky, his eyebrows up, his shoulders too, and the wire basket aslant in his lap. The other passengers shrugging back in answer, satisfied it was just birds and that they flew their own way, but baffled by the outburst of the woman standing up. Fred eyed her in the mirror. His stomach settled for a moment. Nilda, still lifting from her seat, continued to stare at the ceiling agape as though it were a membrane, a veil to look through at the fabulous apparition flying back from the concealed world in the far side of the mind. 4. Obi dumped his clothes in the locker and dropped down on the bench by his daybook. It was starting up again. The factions, the intrigue, a replay of all the old ideological splits, the street youth as vanguard, the workers as vanguard, self-determination in the Black Belt, Black rule of USA, strategic coalitions, independent political action. Camps were forming, threatening to tear the academy apart. He held his gym shoe open, but had no mind to lift his foot. He should make the rounds. Somewhere in the building, an on-the-sly gathering was afoot, no doubt. And tomorrow the polarities would have sharpened, the splits widened. He sat, staring at the cement floor as if for cracks. He wanted wholeness in his life again. Several hotheads, angry they had been asleep in the 60s or too young to participate, had been galvanized by the arrival in their midst of the legless vet who used to careen around Claiborne fast and loose on a hot garage dolly. The tutorial staff were urging the group to pull up the welcome mat, close the doors, and concentrate on building up the bookstore and tape library. The office staff were charging the executive committee with elitism. The study group leaders said the new crop of recruits were apathetic or stupid. The masseuse, karate master, the language teachers, and the resident reggae band, feeling more than estranged, were asking, "Whatever happened to third world solidarity?" And, too, there was the group who came by the house late at night to argue that the academy, too visible and above ground, had performed its function, pulling folks together for a moment. And now that key people had been identified, it should be abandoned and a select group move off to the back district and organize a self-sufficient community. Velma had rejected it as too aloof a way to make a contribution. After several tries, they modified the plan. A select few should nab some devalued real estate near the woods and move off for a year and start a brain trust farm, and finally do what the folks in the 19th century had talked about at the colored people's conventions, finally do what the African Brotherhood had formed to do in the 20s, finally do what had been a priority item in the early 60s, then got pushed aside when the movement was redefined from the outside, but was tried anyway by the Lowndes County Freedom Party, by folks within the Peace and Freedom Party, later by the All African People's Party, what had been discussed in Philly, Little Rock, Gary, and Dayton, Ohio, but yet to be done, to blueprint a surefire strategy for mobilizing the people to form and support an independent black political party before it was too late. There was the Puerto Rican Nationalist Party to hook up with, the La Raza Unida groups still functioning to connect with, the American Indian Movement to ally, and a loose, informal network of medicine people throughout the communities of color to be lifted up and formalized. That had captured his and Velma's attention. But when was there a moment, much less the material resources, to move off for a year? And so the spring festival had been designed as a holding action, way to reconcile the camps, to encourage everyone to work together until the plan could be put to them. But then the hotheads had brought the guns into the place and the splits widened, and Obi had not moved quickly enough, been forceful enough, was overcome with ambivalence. Obi felt the image of himself coming apart in Ahiro's hands. "Have to be whole to see whole," Mrs. Haywood had counseled them. He'd tried to stay on top on all diverse plans and keep the groups with the academy. A deep rift had been developing for centuries, the woman taught, beginning with the move toward the material world and away from nature. Now there was a babble of paths, of plans. "There is a world to be redeemed," she warned, "and it'll take the cooperation of all righteous folks." Obi dropped his shoe and rubbed his chest. He was probably exaggerating, but things had seemed more pulled together when Velma had been there, in the house and at the academy. Not that her talents ran in the peacemaking vein, but there'd been fewer opportunities for splinterings with her around, popping up anywhere at any time to raise a question, audit a class, monitor a meeting, confront, or cooperate. It was all of a piece with Velma around. He'd thought he was relieving her of distraction, suggesting she pare her schedule down, but most often she was either huddled in the Chesterfield, her head dropped to her chest, preoccupied, or out of town keeping company with consoles and terminals with cutesy names like Big Blue. And the two major camps, the ones she'd held together, urging each to teach the other its language, had sprung apart. The one argued relentlessly now for the academy to change its name from Seven Arts to Spirithood Arts and to revamp the program, strip it of material and mundane concerns like race, class, and struggle. The other wanted the flowing ones thrown out and more posters of Lennon, Malcolm, Bessie Smith, and Coltrane put up. Obi bent down and worked his foot into the shoe. He felt the strain in his midriff and wondered if he shouldn't once again invite Women for Action to join them to move from his sister-in-law's studio to the academy. There was more resistance to this idea within the academy than he'd anticipated. It made no sense. The work was the same: to develop, to demystify, to build, to consolidate, and escalate. And they shared key people: Jan, who ran the ceramics and sculpture division, Ruby, who coordinated the newsletter staff, Bertha, who ran the nutrition program. Velma had run the office, done the books, handled payroll, supervised the office staff, and saw to it that they were not overlooked as resource people for seminars, conferences, and trips, wrote the major proposals, and did most of the fundraising. It took him, Jan, Marcus when he was in town, Daisy Moultrie and her mother when they could afford to pay them, the treasurer of the board, and two student interns to replace Velma at the academy. Obi lingered over the laces, the pull in his midsection masking the pain in his chest. Maybe she had come home, cut the job short, quit. She would have come home to an empty house. He should have left a note. "We're staying a few days with Cleotis, or the Hermit, as Velma had tagged him." But he hadn't. She rarely did anymore either. She just hopped a plane to Wisconsin or wherever the computer job was, or took off to Palmas, saying nothing. Although no one over there had summoned her or was sick. Obi was pulling the laces too tight and wagging his head. What simple-ass shit was that? Not leaving her a note because she hadn't left him a note. Fuck a note, anyhow. He swung up, stretched, and then slumped, a sack of stones swaying in his chest. And what did he call himself doing now? Hiding out? Stalling? His whole Johnson was getting raggedy. His home? His work? And he was sitting on a bench in a basement talking to a locker. The fissures at home had yawned wide and something fine had dropped through. He was not taking care of business, and the one thing in the world he had always been about was taking care of business. He turned to explain to the staircase, a more organic, therefore more reasonable listener, he figured, measuring quickly wood versus metal. And then he saw the envelope sticking out of his appointment book. He did not want to read the letter again, or check over his schedule for the day again, or go into the gym, either. But he'd held out the reward of the sauna and a massage to get him through it all. He couldn't just sit there. Things coming apart, and he was sitting it out on the bench. The major parade to begin at midnight, and he was having difficulty getting his shoes on. He didn't recognize himself. He didn't recognize her, either. Restless, lips swollen, circles under her eyes, spellbound, and didn't recognize the versions of her whispered in the halls by people who'd worked with her, knew her. Crackpot. Ever since he'd demanded more of a home life, she'd been in a stew, threatening to boil over and crack the pot all right. Or maybe the cracking had begun years earlier, when the womb had bled, when the walls had dropped away and the baby was flushed out. How long would it take to know the woman? His woman. 2 years living with her before he learned to identify the particular spasm as her coming. He would enter her, throbbing, and she would close around him,
and somewhere, as their hips swung, the bottoms of her feet stroking the fat of his calves, her thunderous buns rocking in the seat of his palms, a muscle would clutch at him, and he'd feel the tremor begin at the tip of his joint. 2 years it took to distinguish her tremor from his pleasure, her orgasm from the vibration in his hands, in his calves, the quivering in his tightened balls. 2 years before her calling out his name in that way would not catch him by surprise. How much longer would it take to learn all of Velma? Someone was on the landing calling him. He straightened up, but did not get up. He had no reason not to answer, but he didn't. It felt right to sit there, his palms now cupping his kneecaps, his feet flat on the floor, one shoe off and one shoe on, his eyes skimming over the envelope toward the stairs. And it drew him together to hear his name called like that, the caller throwing it off the walls, tossing it in the upper hall. It focused him. The calling. And then the going absolutely still, listening for an answer, the whole body and mind absorbed in it, even as Obi sat there stopping his stomach and chest in mid-breath. The caller sighing now, muttering, scraping his shoes against the threshold, then jiggling the doorknob. The way Velma did of late, checking and rechecking the knob, the latch, the catch, not trusting the mechanism to mesh on its own with whatever ratchet caused it to function and keep her exits possible. The house was no longer a comfortable place for her. She veered sharply to avoid things he did not see, would slap her hand over her mouth and press her whole face shut as if to stifle a scream. And the night the bedroom knob came off in his hands, she'd backed down the hall and left the house without a coat. Whoever it was calling him left the door ajar, and Obi followed the footfalls overhead, going toward the kiln. Any minute he expected other steps to sound, the caller to be joined, voices, some confirmation of a clandestine meeting. And when the time came for the procession, he'd discover a palace coup had been effected while he'd sat in the basement with one shoe on. The caller was back at the basement end of the hall, alone, opening doors, and the sudden blast of an electric guitar made Obi start. He found himself clutching the daybook, the envelope, crushed in his grip. He bent and put his other shoe on before he recognized the soloist overhead. He could see young Bobby, his blue embroidered strap across his chest like a bandarillo. Young Bobby taking his Jimmy stance, his hands flying across the strings, releasing the music, holding music in his mouth, holding the next few lines he'd play in his mouth in that pretty way that never resembled an upchuck, no matter how much Velma teased. His brother, Bobby, flooding the halls, the basement, playing the feedback, his main man on the amp. Fiddling with the dials and letting the audience know just when something extra hip was coming up. And then the door was closed before he could hear what he always heard from his younger brother's music. Come join me here. Come join me here. Obi moved the book and envelope away from him and breathed deeply. They got me up here in Rikers, man. He planted a foot on the bench and rolled his sock down, remembering that Rikers, like so many joints where the family is caged, had been built on top of a garbage dump. They had his brother, Roland, in prison for rape this time, and Obi knew it was no bum rap. He let his foot fall to the floor. They got me up here mopping floors, bro. She'd been mopping up her own blood with the mop Roland had threatened her with, taken from her, and hit her with, surprising her from the garage window. Mopping up her own blood when the police arrived. A black woman, 46 years old, 4 children, her husband in the reserves for 9 days. Roland climbing in the window, stepping over bikes, skateboards, stacks of comics, a burnt-out TV. She'd been in the kitchen, mopping the floor. Roland had sent him the newspaper clippings.
Oh, shit, man. Ain't like she was a virgin.
Obi had flown up for the trial.
Shit, she was probably on the pill.
And he had studied them both. Roland, hard mouth and surly, his head dropped to the side, bobbing like the hydrophobic patient he'd helped Doc Surge get to the hospital 3 summers before.
Don't cry, bitch, or I'll really hurt you.
The woman huddled on the stand, pinched, nasal, but determined to get justice.
Be good to me. Ain't nobody been good to me.
She might have been their Aunt Frances, an older sister. She was.
Be sweet now, and I'll be gone for your children get back. They got me in a box, man. When you going to get me out?
Obi'd gone to see him in the tombs, hand grabbing at his clothes, mildew rotting the shirt off his back.
This is fucked up, Roland,
he had started to say, but Roland was talking about the money, the debt. We're richer than the land, Roland. But he didn't get a chance to say what he meant, Roland cutting through with a sneer and talking not about the land their father had tried to give them after nearly 15 years of absence, but about the fact that Obi had rejected his share too and the portion of their dead mother's rights. And maybe that had been a big mistake, he wanted to say, but Roland was calling him big man, revolutionary man, straight up and down, got it all together man, and there was no room for talking.
Be good to me, bitch, 'cause no one else has, so you take the weight.
The cramped and scribbly writing, though, was saying other things about the lame lawyer, the racist judge, the kangaroo court, the vengeful bitch, the rough-off artists in the joint, the lead pipe shakedowns, the lousy food, the lousy break. No cigarettes, no money, no visitors, no luck, no pussy. He'd actually written that he was so horny he'd fuck a rat if it stood still.
Don't scream, bitch. Clench those muscles down there and be good to me.
The woman had held herself together on the stand to get it all said, trembling for justice.
I need to get out of here. Are you going to come through for me, brother man?
Obi bent to roll his other sock down. He was feeling dizzy, nauseous, but not like those mornings in the beginning when they thought the baby was on the way. Sour now, sweet then, until they learned they had lost their child. They were running a bookstore then, rolling the paperback racks to the wall to make room for the Shea Lumumba Club on Monday nights and the local Panthers on Tuesday nights, and the Young Lords on Wednesday nights and Sophie Haywood's study group on Thursday nights. Everyone seemed to be pulling in the same direction then. But that, of course, was selective memory, a chump way to excuse the self from the chaos of the moment, longing for a past or a future as if there were no continuum, and no real thread that energized and carried one, as if timepieces ticked away in separate lockers he could open, close, lock up, climb into, or fall out of.
I'm your brother, man. Come through for me. You do it for everybody else. I'm blood.
Obi tossed the daybook into the locker and kicked it closed. The gym smelled funky. When Velma and the sisters had been taking karate, the maintenance crew had made a point of cleaning regularly. Now it was necessary to keep the windows open to give the place an airing. Obi stood at the window, stretching out to the wind to feel its purpose. Arms wide, legs apart in an open body position. He was sure there was a plan, a pattern that would reveal itself if he'd but stay available to it. He sensed a plan of growth for himself, for him and Thelma, for the Academy, for the national community, for the planet, felt it too strongly, too often, too thoroughly to despair. And so he stretched and breathed deeply, trying to pay attention to what he saw and heard and felt around him and inside. Outside in the yard that doubled as parking lot and general hangout, the motorcycle club was gathering. Leather pants, jackets, silver studs spelling out names and threats, crushed hats or helmets, gloves, men straddling bikes or standing around profiling, the women seated, waiting. Obi eyed the women sitting with their backs to the window, their asses splayed out on the black leather seats or leopard skin seat covers, or held from spreading by thick denim or tight leather. Their backs arched as they held on to fenders behind them, their backs bent as they leaned forward, grabbing at the ape hangers. Women. Women talking in bits and pieces, mostly waiting, mostly impatient waiting, waiting for the men to straddle the machines and turn on the power and take them somewhere. In the beginning, Thelma had asked about the women. Did he still see any of them? Were they at least friends? And he had shrugged. What was there to say? He'd thought himself deeply in love each time. And they'd loved him. At least they'd each said they did. But they kept killing his babies. Junk food addicts, toxemic pregnancies, miscarriages. Excited mothers-to-be, suddenly sullen and unreachable, terror-stricken. Abortions, pills and foams and curses and shouts and long harangues about, "You must be kidding. You think I'm some fool? You sweet-talking, no-dealing or double-dealing jive ass. Drop your seed any old where and keep stepping, and what am I supposed to do? Kiss my ass and later for all the fucked-up nigger man shit." The pattern is clear. And the new pattern of growth unfolded itself the minute Thelma had winced and held him round. "What kind of poor, abused sister would want to kill your baby, James?" The plan had unfolded, the plan of work and development, partially at least. But now he was stumped. Where to take the Academy, and where was his partnership going? What was he to do about Roland, about Thelma, about anybody? He was halfway out of the window, his chest swelled, his arms out as if measuring his wingspan, his nostrils burning from too big an intake of air, his lungs stuttering as he tried to expel it all before he burst. The men and women in leather were saluting him, yelling hello up at him, waving at him. Shine glinting off black goggles and dark shades and something in him lifting an arm to wave back. And then two women bent, leaned their heads in together, tipped the bikes to whisper. He could see their lips in the side mirror that angled away from the handlebars, whispering and looking back at him. Crackpot. Someone a few days ago had actually called Thelma a crackpot. How fitting, though, when he thought about it. Something was definitely percolating with a fury, bubbling up and running over the sides. She eyed him these days from within a crusty depression, huddled in the Chesterfield, picking at herself as at a sore. She might catch fire any minute, break the vessel, and all he knew of her, drain off, become ignited, burn away. Obi held on to the window jamb and tried to exhale his chest and stomach flat. 5. Nadine saw it happen, saw something drop away from Mrs. Henry's face. Nadine had not wanted to move closer, but was glad Buster had moved her off the spot. 'Cause if she'd gone on standing there, she would have run screaming into the halls. and if she'd gone on standing there, she would have found some way to get on top of a table and clog away in them shoes Mrs. Haywood had gotten on her about. If she'd gone on standing there, she would have had to make some kind of move and some kind of noise. She still wanted to make some noise, wanted something loud going on, something louder than just the scratchy sound of Buster's mustache against her face, louder than the new whispery way he'd been talking lately in her ear, louder than the swish of his corduroy pants as he left her. She could never go down into the cellar without noise, without grabbing the old muffin tin off the hook and scraping it along the wall, scraping her knuckles sometimes, but she didn't care, 'cause the main thing was not to hear the mice or the rats or the squirrels or whoever they were scurrying around down there when she went for the maternity clothes in her aunt's trunk, or home alone or babysitting by herself. She'd have the radio, stereo, and the TV all going full blast and calling anybody, Cynthia even, to talk and laugh with to get the spooky dark to stop in the hall and no fair creeping past the line of the door. She'd pray when she turned for a second to bite the sides of her thumbs. She didn't know what she saw fall or what she saw once, whatever it was that fell away from Mrs. Henry. But the whole thing was scary, at least at first it was, and she kept trying to put the brakes on, but Buster kept on inching them closer, and then it wasn't scary at all. Felt okay. She felt a straightening. What she caught a bit of at the falling away did something to her spine, made her stretch up like they were always telling her to do at the clinic. Only not a real reaching, like into high cupboards or the top shelf of the linen closet, just to think up and stretch the spine. So she'd made up a game in the past 3 weeks of hanging pecan pies up in the air, of hanging up cans of root beer and sometimes bundles of dollar bills that she could have only if the top of her hair knocked them down from the make-believe strings and she could catch them. Minnie, too, was feeling up, was clucking her tongue against the roof of her mouth and humming. Velma's frequency was lowering as she danced away from the humming toward music of an earlier moment, the radio by the bed. Velma's growling, a groan, now swirling round the concentric circles in the roof of her mouth in search of a seam, a break in the curvature, a way to get out and away from the sour sweet taste of sex coating her tongue. Obie whispering hoarsely in her ear about the moist coils of her tunnel, drawing him in deeper. And she wanting to deny him herself, to hold back, to deny herself, to withdraw into the sheets tangled under her knees. Her groaning spiraling up to break through the roof of her mouth and thunder up to her brain. Velma's frequency sharper as she drifted back toward Minnie's humming. And they met somewhere in the air, near the window, Minnie and Velma, pulling against each other and then together. Then holding each other up out of the fall, holding each other stable on stools. "You'll have to choose, sweetheart. Choose your own cure. Choose." Sleep riding and sleep talking, not sure where she was, Velma felt herself sinking. The passengers in the bus incident were not sure where they were either, or why they should be sinking into the marshes, their spirits yawning upward, their eyes throwing up images on the walls of the mind, the bus rocking, slipping down for a tour of the caverns, Nilda Wyandotte looking at Cecile's straw hat, the gold weights from the motherland hanging from the brim, the whittled figures and palmetto charms from home dangling from the inside of the wide brim. Cecile Satterfield looking at Nilda's hat, a black felt Andes affair with a straight as the crow flies feather stuck in the band, as was customary for a traveler away from home. Seeing each other as in a dream, only just now recalled. Recognizing each other as sister friend for life, they fly up out of the roof of that bus and are back on the road in another. Fred Holt at the bottom of the marshes with the steering wheel off and in his hands, trying to comprehend the new situation by apprehending it like an amoeba, swarming around it, surrounding it, absorbing it. Then Porter, appearing in hip boots like he'd been fishing on a Sunday morning, hailing him. "How you faring, brother man?" And him saying right back, fair to muddling, and you?" And Porter looking up through the green and grinning. "The toss was boss, but the pitch was a bitch. A sunken bus? Can a nigga live?" The two of them talking rapidly, adjusting fast to underwater muscles, not sure what else they might be called upon to adjust to in the next few minutes, so talking fast about firsts, since firsts are appropriate at new beginnings. The first big fight, Porter dreaming of the golden gloves, remembering the climb into the ring all right, but the next memory, the sting of smelling salts in the nostrils, the first car. Fred's 1937 green Pontiac and the best damn chariot ever made. The first woman, or at least the first time they got their pants creamed and their hands sticky. And when Nadine got over being scared and finished with stretching her spine, she felt still another thing about seeing Mrs. Henry's face lift off and a prettier woman appear. She felt special, felt smart, like she'd never felt at home or at school. Something important was happening, and she was part of it. Something bigger than the 2+2 way everybody else lived from day to day was going on, and she was right there and part of it. Whatever it was that had fallen away was showing her another way to be in the world. "There's nothing that stands between you and perfect health, sweetheart. Can you hold that thought?" "Nothing can hold me from my good," Velma drawled, reciting a remembered Sunday school lesson. "Neither famine, nor evil, nor..." A barrier falling away between adulthood and child, like the barrier that dropped away for the passengers on the highway, silent and still in the hum of the wheels over asphalt, silent and still in the sonic boom echoing back from a blasting event to occur several years hence, and to occur with so powerful an impact, its after effect ripples backward and spreads over their moment now, giving them a glimpse of their scripts, which they can acknowledge and use, or ignore and have to re-experience as new. Always the choice, but with attention able to change directions as sharply and as matter-of-factly as the birds winging toward Claiborne. And then, a fourth thing. Nadine felt a kinship with the woman she did not even know, had never met, had only heard about from Buster, who lived on her block, or from Mrs. Haywood, who considered both her and the woman her goddaughters. She'd seen the covers fall, knew the feeling, the nakedness of it. Graduating from the shelter of closed-in desks wide enough to hide behind with fingernail polish and love notes and a stick of gum thrumbled up small and tight for popping right into the mouth behind the desk lid. Then suddenly, the wide-open one-armed chairs of high school and everything out, the drooping socks, the ashy legs, the banged-up knees, the too short hand-me-down clothes stretched over her swelling belly. But Mrs. Henry didn't grab herself up small and tight on the stool or try to duck her head down and hide or anything. She wasn't even trying to fix herself up in front of all the people, didn't even check to see if the hospital gown was open, which it was, and if her behind was out, which it wasn't, 'cause she had on panties, but still. So Nadine didn't feel like clenching her thighs tight anymore, or putting the brakes on with her shoes anymore. She moved closer, all on her own, Buster not even there, because it was all right now. And this was the real thing, and she was about to know, or maybe already knew, something her smart-ass friend Cynthia, for all her knowing, would probably never know. Nadine knew she was not the stupid girl her teachers thought she was, or the silly child the nurses thought she was. "Babies having babies," her neighbors had sighed. She could argue now with folks at the clinic. How come she was old enough to sign the papers giving consent for the baby to be taken care of when it came, but wasn't old enough to sign for herself, had to have her aunt and the social worker give consent? It was always the same. Too old to do this, too young to do that. No more. Nadine moved closer and would have moved right up to the two stools to join hands with the healer and the woman if the prayer group weren't there around the two like a gate. She was a woman. Or at least, she wrinkled her nose to herself at too big a jump. She was womanish. "Can you afford to be whole?" Minnie was sing-songing it, the words, the notes ricocheting around the room. Mr. Daniels picked out one note and matched it, then dug under it, then climbed over it. His brother, from the opposite side of the circle, glided into harmony with him while the rest of the group continued working to pry Velma Henry loose from the gripping power of the disease and free her totally into Minnie Ransom's hand, certain of total cure there. "Can you afford it? Is what I'm asking you, sweetheart." Minnie persisted, ignoring the sighs of impatience that issued from the visiting doctors, nurses, and technicians. Several checked their watches, amazed that only 5 minutes of silence had ensued. It had seemed so much longer, that quiet moment broken by one of their members reciting the Hippocratic Oath, then exiting. 5 minutes or not, there was still the lecture to be worked in before they reassembled in the lounge to pick up their conference kits and jackets and compare notes. The slideshow and talk the administrator, Dr. Surge, would present that would answer all the questions put on hold at the morning session about the history of the infirmary, about the fusion of Western medicine and the traditional arts, about the drug rehab acupuncture clinic, about this healing business, and about the controversial liaison with agencies such as the Academy of the Seven Arts, that was bound to take more than an hour. And it was no short stretch of leg to the corner where the driver, Fred Holt, would be waiting, but not too long, he had made clear, for departure. Several shifted their weight from one leg to the other, trying to get the group's attention, trying to get a consensus about leaving. Many of the strollers in, lily cups in hand, passes or prescription slips flapping and rustling, were as eager for Dr. Surge's talk as the visitors, particularly the part about how the workers of old held steadfast against the so-called setting of standards, the licensure laws, the qualifying exams, the charges of quackery or charlatanism or backwardness, the attempt to take over the medical arts by the spiritual and material capitalists. Things always got right lively then, and it was almost as pleasurable hearing Doc Surge knock down all of the visitors' arguments as it was to hear about the courage and resourcefulness of the old bone setters, the old medicine show people, the grannies and midwives, the root men, the conjure women, the Obia folks, and the medicine people of the Yamasi and Yamacra who helped the Southwest Community Infirmary defend itself and build itself through the years. The rest of the old-timers, though, remained in deep concentration, matching the prayer group in silence and patience. For sometimes, a person held on to sickness with a fearsomeness that took 20 hard-praying folk to loosen. So used to being unwhole and unwell, one forgot what it was to walk upright and see clearly, breathe easily, think better than was taught, be better than one was programmed to believe. So concentration was necessary to help a neighbor experience the best of herself or himself. For people sometimes believed that it was safer to live with complaints, was necessary to cooperate with grief, was all right to become an accomplice in self-ambush. They were proud, frequently, the patients that came to Mrs. Ransom. They wore their crippleness or blindness like a badge of honor, as though it meant they'd been singled out for some special punishment, were special. Or as though it meant they'd paid some heavy dues and knew then what there was to know and therefore had a right to certain privileges or were exempt from certain charges or ought to be listened to at meetings. But way down under, knowing special was a lie, knowing better all along and feeling the cost of the lie, of the self-betrayal in the joints, in the lungs, in the eyes. Knew, felt the cost, but were too proud and too scared to get downright familiar with the conniption fit, getting downright familiar with their bodies, minds, spirits, to just sing, blues, how do you do? Sit down, let's work it out. Took heart to flat out decide to be well and stride into the future sane and whole, and it took time. So the old-timers and the circle concentrated on their work, for of course patients argued, fought, resisted, just as Mrs. Velma Henry was fighting still what was her birthright. Sweetheart. Minnie was crooning, taking up both hands of the patient and clutching them in her lap. While the others watched, not quite sure what to make of what was apparently happening to the patient, Cora Ryder was jutting out her bony chest, certain it was she who had routed the noisy doctor, sent him out of the room with his blasphemous prayer.
Apollo, she snorted to herself. No telling who a red bone will call on when faced with the black truth, she chuckled to herself. Bad as them workers down at the chemical plant,
she fussed under her breath, not sure yet why the two seemed connected in her head, forming a committee to whine complaints to the very uglies who were making life so miserable in the first place, calling on the big shots, hat in hand and bent at the knees and all, as if the big shots cared a hoot about safety gloves and ventilation and special ways to deal with asbestos and all them poisons down there, when who them workers should have been calling on were the crazy characters that had broken into the armory and stolen a lot of guns.
Men. Lord, Lord, Cora.
Cora rolled her eyes at her sighing friend, Anna Banks, forever calling on the Lord for something she ought to be able to handle herself, and the first to get high-handed with her about playing numbers when no commandment said a thing about gambling, but sure had a thing or two to say about taking the Lord's name in vain. When they played cards on Friday nights, Anna Banks called on Jesus, like Jesus ain't got nothing better to do than be her whist partner. And when Cora and her partner ran a Boston and reminded Anna the game was rise and fly, why then she'd call on her mama, poor dead woman roaming around on the other side trying to get her bearings and her fool daughter yelling at her to stack the deck on the next go-round to teach Cora and Bertha a lesson. It was enough to make you bust a girdle. Cora roared inside, assuming you was dumb enough to wear one in the first place. But that doctor beat all. Probably the first time he'd ever had a chance to learn something useful about curing and caring. And he right away calling out people from fairy tales. Might just as well try to get Goldilocks on the telephone for all the good Apollo could do.
Damn fool. Cora, please, Lord.
Just like the patient that morning, stumbling in, calling on guns, calling on a joy pill, calling on her dead mama. Instead of putting herself in the hands of the very one God had groomed for just such occasions, the good woman Ransom.
"I feel so bad,"
she had wailed, setting Cora's teeth on edge.
"I want to blow my brains out. Give me something."
And Cora had wanted to pull at her own hair the way the woman kept doing, as if guns and pills grew there and all that henna for the picking.
"I don't want to feel this way," she kept shouting,
and the louder she got and the more she banged herself all in the face, the more the room tipped for Cora till she felt knocked right out of her shoes, and the good woman urging the wailer to let her mama go, to go ahead and hurt and holler, but to let the woman go.
"Hold my hand, daughter," she had coaxed the wailing woman. "Let me share your pain and your joy. I hurt with you and rejoice with you, for your mama's finished with this and gone on to come again another way."
But then the woman just climbed into Miss Ransom's lap and liked to knock the chair right over and still yelling about give her some magic pill, wanted to swallow her mother and grief with the pill, drink down sorrow and keep her inside as though a daughter could give birth to her own mother. It was enough to scare the pants off of you. Great big overgrown woman wanting to be Miss Ransom's baby and her mama's mama all at the same time and sliding off Miss Ransom's lap, the whole room on the slide, it had seemed, to Cora. But Cora held up, did not faint or embarrass herself. Miss Ransom, rocking that woman like the mothers of all times hold and rock however large the load, never asking whose baby or how old or is it deserving, only that it's a baby and not a stone. But all that was changing, and that was the part that was really knocking Cora off her center these days. 'Cause she'd been there. And she'd seen the little children brought into the place, burned, beaten, stabbed, stomped, starved, dropped, flung, dumped in boiling water. It was a sign of the times, too much to bear, but she held on and never fainted and never lost her faith. Invalid mother-in-law, cranky and smelly, rifled mailbox and neighbor kids in her yard with no manners, beauticians lying that they didn't get a chance to put in her number, smart aleck youngsters telling her she was killing people in Africa by giving crime men her gambling money, church folks igging her 'cause she didn't dress fancy. But Cora Ryder held on. Didn't traffic in gossip, wished no one ill, kept the faith, 'cause her dreams assured her of one thing, if nothing else, that she would be rewarded when things turned right side round again. What goes around, comes around. So Cora continued with good works and a life of harmlessness. And she stuck out her bony chest and rubbed her eyes dry against the fluff of her sweater. "Answer me now," Minnie insisted, leaning into Velma Henry.
"Afford? Choose?"
Velma groaned, sore and sodden, coming in from the muddy planks, stumbling, her feet entangled in sheets, reeling toward the sound of tambourines and joy, reeling and rocking on the stool, the mud going white linoleum underfoot, the tent canvas, the bedroom walls yellow latex paint, and the sting of disinfectant overpowering, making her squint.
"But I thought..."
"You think I mean money?" Nadine's eyes were riveted on Mrs. Henry's wrists now, thick brown wrists no longer banded by narrow red and black bracelets of flaking flesh. Healed. Nadine felt a movement at the base of her stomach. Something leaped in her, like the baby Jesus leapt when Elizabeth, big with John, saluted Mary. she stretched her ears toward the woman. Would she ever finish answering whatever it was the healer was asking, or would she just reel and rock on the stool until all the scars were healed? Nadine breathed shallowly in light pants, as they often did in practice class. She was oblivious to the sharp intake of breath, the gasps, the stirrings around her as others began to take notice. This was the real thing. She had never seen a real healing. Her aunt had taken her to the summer tents, promising circus, but that didn't count. Wasn't the real thing. A turkey neck preacher throwing some poor cripple down on the platform and shouting, "Heal! Heal! Heal!" Like being saved that time, the preacher plunging her under, and for nights and nights the drowning dreams, the claws of seaweed dragging her down and her crawling on the water's floor, eyes and ears sealed in mud, then waking with crumbling teeth and frozen jaws, not knowing where on earth she was, and Aunt Myrtle by the bed on her knees, ready to turn the nightmare into a vision of Jesus, a visit from God.
"God don't lead you to deep waters to drown you, Nadine," she would whisper, "merely to cleanse you."
And would then want to hear her confession and the message from God, and would insist they go to the tents for a confirmation. Revival healing was just not it. The rolling in sawdust, the talking in tongues, the horns blaring and people crying, folks tearing off their clothes, the little kids whimpering. Grown people, grown-up adults who pinched you in church for squirming, who passed you on the block and told you to pull up your socks and be tidy, who got after you about your schoolwork or about wearing your hair to the side or with a streak, who told you to keep your pants up and your dress down, who stood up at meetings and said the younger generation had no self-control and no sense, rolling all over the ground, their clothes all messed up and underwear on show, talking out of their heads, totally off their nut. That was not the real thing. And them spooky sessions in the woods her younger cousin used to dare her to, sneaking off in the night with two pair of kitchen curtains to tuck and pin around their hips like skirts. She hoped and prayed they weren't the real thing. The bloody chickens, the stuck pigs, the dancing men with their red glow cigars, and women, too, puffing like chimneys on a train. Everybody jerking and shaking like they were having a bad time, and couples dancing, doing the nasty, sweat pouring off them and their clothes like rainy window panes. She didn't want that to be the real thing. No. And though her younger cousin would climb over the fence and throw herself into it, Nadine preferred to watch through the fence and then run on home. 'Cause no. That was not the real thing. That was some kind of crazy business, and dangerous, too. Knives and swords and burning sticks and garden tools twirling, and the dancers with their eyes closed, crowded as it was. No, this was the real thing. This was what it was supposed to be. A clean, freshly painted, quiet music room with lots of sunlight. People standing about, wishing Mrs. Henry well, and knowing Miss Ransom would do what she said she would do. Miss Ransom, known to calm fretful babies with a smile or a pinch of the thigh, known to cool out nervous wives who bled all the time and couldn't stand still, known to dissolve hard lumps in the body that the doctors at the county hospital called cancers. This was the real thing. Miss Ransom, in her flouncy dress and hip shoes with flowers peeking out of her turban and smelling like coconut afro spray. Even Cousin Dorcas, who had gone to specialists as far away as Boston, said this was the real place and Miss Ransom was the real thing. And even Buster, who never gave anybody a play, even Buster, who had to be begged to come to the infirmary, had to be threatened by Uncle Thurston to take the father classes, even Buster had said Miss Ransom was for real, and Buster didn't even say that about his own mother. But he had told Nadine that if she was really pregnant and not just trying to fuck with his mind, and if the sucker did manage to grow to anything, well then, he guessed it would be cool for the old lady to be in the delivery room when the time came. Nadine folded her arms over the swell of her baby and wished the two women would get on with whatever was left to do. It was getting kind of spooky again, the two of them rocking and clutching with their eyes closed and Miss Ransom's hand trembling and all. She'd heard these sessions were usually quick, that sometimes she simply hugged you and then you jumped right up and bumped all the way home. It was a little after 3. She hoped it wouldn't be much longer. She had a bone to pick with the bossy nurse at the teen clinic, and she had a fitting at 4 o'clock. She was not going to the carnival ball in anything but a fine gown, not with her belly out the way it was. She could just see Cynthia looking at her sideways, saying, "Girl, what's your malfunction? You look like a penguin."
Afford?
Velma was still muttering like she'd never heard the word before.
"Oh, I don't mean money, sweetheart. You know that."
Velma guessed she did. Nearly everyone in Claiborne knew that much. It was chiseled over the archway of the infirmary. Health is your right. Translated by popular practice, pay what you can, when you can, if at all. Yes, she knew that, if she didn't know anything else on that stool, head numb, eyes crossed, circuits blown, working hard to get herself together to at least pay attention to the lift and stretch of the old woman's arm reaching toward the stereo dials. Music? Music. She had thought she'd heard some music. Well, what was this anyway? A healing or a jam session? Velma was spinning in the music. A teenager at the rink in a fluffy white angora and a black and white checked skating skirt, spinning in some corny My Gal Sal merry-go-round organ grinder music. Just the thing, the skaters joked, to keep black folks off balance. Spinning. The photo-lined walls, the concession stand, the rows of lockers, the entranceway, the organ stall, all flying around, merging. Photos on the lockers, the mayor shaking hands with a keyboard, the organist playing the cash register in the entranceway to the ladies' room, racks of hot dogs suspended from the lobby light, spinning, the mud mothers on the ice building a fire, fanning the babies, trying to scream, or maybe it was the weight in her left-hand pocket that was tipping her to the side, a rock a white kid had thrown at them from the bus, a bracelet Palma's best friend had stolen from the 5 and 10, her keys, the weight pulling her to the side, the left blade not planted quite right on the ice. But Velma, afraid to think on it, corrected lest her ankles bump and she fall, or worse, she spin and twist like the Turkish taffy figures in cartoons. Spinning, and something very much the matter. Radios going, and slideshows and movies and the records of special effects, waterfalls and buffalo stampedes and guns and high-pitched wailing and chanting. Spinning, and then the women by the turnstile covered with leaves, covered with mud, and it's too cold for them babies, young Velma wants to shout out. But the words bubble like foam in the chapped cracks round her mouth, then whip around her cheek, the back of her neck, her ear, and seal her mouth closed. "I can feel it when something ain't right," Lorraine was saying to Jan that time, her foot out of her mules and on the kick wheel, her thigh bunching through the shiny skirt she'd kept from the old days, the pottery wheel spinning. And Velma was like the lump of clay, two hands holding her on the wheel, one hand pushing her hard up against the other in an effort to get her centered, and she was turning and lifting at last, the ridges of her sides smoothing out, rising moist and spreading, opening up, flaring out, but a lump in the beat, the rhythm wobbly, the healer's hands steadying her, coaxing her up all of a piece.
Like being in bed with a black trick who's been sleeping white a long time, you know?
Lorraine, hiding her eyes, certain she'd gotten the attention of the girls.
The beat's just off.
She paused while they howl.
Way off.
A loss of rhythm, Jan said slowly, mulling it over.
The ceramics group, too intrigued with what Lorraine is wearing and saying and promising for the afternoon, to pay much attention to Jan's efforts to bring them back round to the clay. Jan, leaning, holding her hands over Lorraine's jug as if it might spring off any minute.
A lump somewhere.
Muttering it, not wanting to interrupt the dialogue between the girls and Lorraine or miss the points of correspondence on what's beginning to look like an interesting parallel. Velma holding up one of the plaster bases, chipping a piece off. The girls can watch Jan and Velma and listen to Lorraine and get several lessons in one.
Sleep white and your rhythm goes right off.
A piece of plaster from the base is buried in the clay, throwing the jug off its axis. They all can hear the offbeat.
That Riley boy's on the offbeat track. You watch and see,
Lorraine said to Jan and Velma, and the whole group watched the jug wobble up sideways as if it were Teddy Riley himself.
Let's concentrate on the clay now,
Jan finally said, clearing her throat with a theatrical flourish, just as the sliver of plaster came tearing through the terracotta walls. Velma tapped Ruby and then tucked her feet under her on the couch and tried not to give Robert a target. She didn't blame him for being warm. Jan had picked a not-so-cool time to do what she was doing. She was tracking him across the carpet, throwing her hands about, trying to explain how difficult it is to pull up straight if you're a girl and no women are getting their wagons around you, or if you're a boy and no men are getting their wagons in a circle. Robert was lining his golf club up with the edge of an old bugle bell. There was a bridge made of wooden hangers tied together with the pants rod removed, several psych jars of water, and some pebbles from the fish tank strewn about the carpet for effect.
Look, that's his business, or his father's, Robert said,
and Jan, waiting for him at the bugle bell, was pressing the soft V at the base of her throat as if to dislodge a fishbone.
You could talk to him, Robert.
They all watched the golf ball roll under the chair and then drag another inch forward on the shag.
And just what am I supposed to say to him? The sisters don't like you humping white girls? Keep off the heights for they lynch a boy?
Oh, Robert.
And Ruby muttering that what somebody needs to do is get a wad of lamb's wool and a can of chloroform and bring the brother home. Robert's